Do you need a lot of money to start angel investing? Our guests today are Alap and Tony from XA Network, a leading tech investment network in Southeast Asia. They'll demystify the world of angel investing and why they're bullish about investing in the region's startup scene.
I hope you enjoy it. And if you do, be sure to subscribe and consider leaving us a review and sharing it with your friends.
Welcome to another episode of In Your Best Interest, your personal finance podcast. I'm your host, Philip Müller, and today we'll be talking about angel investing. Angel investors provide financial backing and support for early stage companies and entrepreneurs to get their businesses off the ground. Today, we're joined by two guests who will share how you can get started as an angel investor, how much money you need, when you might expect a return on investment, and much more. The first guest is Tony Zamykowski, and he's the Vice President for Business Development for Netflix in the Asia-Pacific region. Before Netflix, he ran the international operations for Victorious, a Kleiner Perkins-backed startup in the mobile video space. Our second guest joining us today is Alap Bharadwaj, and Alap leads Google APAC Partner Innovation Practice, an organization dedicated to the launch of novel applications of Google's AI and AR technology in APAC with Google's partners. Previously, Alap and his team worked with several technology unicorns and startups in Southeast Asia to launch digital marketing strategies, product partnerships, ecosystem development, and more. Alap, Tony, that's a big introduction, and I welcome you both to our podcast. We're so pleased to have you.
Thank you, Philippe. Thanks for having us.
Great to be here.
Yeah, thank you so much. Those are impressive resumes from both of you. Really excited to get into the topic of angel investing. It's a topic that we have gotten a lot of requests about. I think maybe that has something to do, you know, with low interest rates and people are eager to invest their cash into different ventures other than their normal ETFs and, you know, bonds and fixed deposits. Before you get into this, I usually ask a lot of all of our listeners, actually, a lot of questions about, you know, how they grow up and, you know, kind of where they come from, especially when we talk more about personal finances. I think with your introductions and your bios, we already got a lot of those answers. But one question I do have for you is that we always ask is, what did you do with your first paycheck when you came out of college?
So maybe I can take that question first. Thanks for asking, Philippe. So what did I do with my first paycheck? I put money aside for buying my very first property.
Very good. What was the decision behind that? Did any particular reason why you were going for property?
Yeah, it's because of my grandparents. They always told me that I should own my house, and so for some reason it became very important to me to basically make that decision right when I got my very first paycheck. So it was deeply ingrained in my mindset.
And I can tell, we have not talked about this before, but are you from Europe?
That's right. I'm from Paris. Yes.
Yeah, okay. So I'm from Germany. It's the same thing, right? Real estate is the one thing that, at least in Germany as well, everyone tells you, hey, grandparents, parents, right? You should own your home.
That's right.
Yeah, Alap, what about yourself?
So mine was a bit different. My first paycheck went into buying, I think, two or three stocks. I graduated and landed a job in investment banking. So it was very close to the markets, was working with some of these publicly listed companies on mergers and acquisitions. And so, you know, was just like, all right, if I really need to be successful in my work, then a little bit of my personal income needs to go towards that as well. So I don't remember what the stocks were, but I bought a couple. Yeah. And then I think maybe 40% of it was just savings in the bank. So 60% went to stocks.
Awesome. No, thank you for those answers. We get like all kinds of different answers from people, you know, paying off their parents' mortgage to, you know, investing in gold because that's what they were used to. So I think that those are awesome, awesome answers. They're very personal. But I thank you guys for sharing it. So let's accelerate the discussion a little bit and go into the topic, right? We wanted to talk about angel investing. And I think we brought two guys in that really know this stuff. So I'm really grateful to have you guys here. But we get people listening to this podcast from all walks of life, right? So if a person doesn't know what angel investing is, what would
How do you guys explain angel investing to people? It's very simple. Angel investing is essentially a high net worth individual that are investing directly in companies. And most of them are actually investing in technology startups. And typically what an angel investor would do is going above and beyond just, you know, writing a check and also, you know, working very closely with the founder.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add to that is there is a reason and an opportunity for this to happen. And that is because inherently with technology companies, the return expectation is, you know, in the many multiples. So you could have a return that's 30x to 100x, right? It's quite plausible if you can get into one of those massively successful companies. It is inherently very risky as well. And that's why in order to navigate that risk, what Tony mentioned before becomes very important. Angel investors who actually roll their sleeves up and help companies at that early stage are disproportionately impactful to the success of that company. So I think there is that opportunity that most people end up wondering about, which is why would you do this so early? The reason is that there's an outsized opportunity at the end of it.
Definitely there is the, definitely there is the, it's a risky asset.
Yeah,
right?
Outsized opportunity.
But I think what you get is not only, you know, the return, is also, you know, the opportunity to give back to the ecosystem and also to, as an executive, to sharpen your skills, right? Because as an angel investor, you get exposed, you know, to different kind of tech companies, different kind of industries. So you basically fast track your learning, which is not something you can only do when you work in a large corporation.
No, absolutely. And I think both of you mentioned one point as well. One thing is giving capital to ideas and founders, right? As an angel investor. But the other one is you bring something to the table that is of value to startups or at value to those startup companies. And I think that's what I deeply resonate with. I've made about 10 different investments into various startups at the angel investing stage. And it was always, I come from a finance background, right? So most of the actual investments came about because, you know, I'm from the finance background. They're very good at the product and they're very good at marketing, but they were looking to bring people in that can actually help them in areas that they're not so good in. For example, for me, it was always like helping them on the finance side, maybe even raising the first real round, right? A seed round or, you know, Series A round for them. So I always feel like when it comes to angel investing, the great part there is you can have real impact and really help them out with your expertise. Is that something that
you guys would see as well, or is this how you bring yourself in? One vector. I think the other vector is that there are multiple times where we are just grateful to be involved with a company. You know, you'll have phenomenal founders who are going after a phenomenally large market, you know, and trying to solve it in this unique way. And then the onus, the impetus of providing value is on you, where the founder is actually extremely capable and you have to help her, you know, in ways that even they might not know because they're doing so much of it. And so, you know, it goes both ways. You could, you know, actually help someone who's very, you know, very formidable by showing them things that they are not quite seeing. You could also help someone who's maybe very inexperienced, very young, with things that they know they need. And so I would, you know, if anyone who's taking these steps, I would always encourage them to look at both sides.
It's also being a trusted advisor and really helping the founder to connect with people from your network, right? I mean, I've been helping a founder in a way. I open up doors for them when they need, you know, a connection, you know, with one potential customer or even a VC if they are actually fundraising.
No, that's great. And then do you normally, when you first, you know, meet a potential startup to invest in, do you believe that the idea of the product or the idea of the business is the most important, or are you actually looking more at the founders and the team? Is that more important?
We invest very early stage, and it's most of the time pre-product, pre-revenues, so there is pretty much no traction. So I think the most important piece is really the funding team. So you look at their background, but also whether or not you feel that they are resilient enough that they can pivot if things go wrong, right? So for me, the funding team is very important. And a bonus as well is when it is repeat founders. So when they had a success in the past or when they built a company before. And then the second piece is the size of the market. But I would say, the market might change, depending on how the startup is going to pivot. I mean, one good example would be Uber, right? Some of the VCs in the Valley passed on Uber because they thought that the Uber market was just the limousine market. And in fact, it was much bigger. It was the mobility market.
Yeah, I would say just to add to that, there is a unofficial sort of understanding or statistic in the venture capital and early stage investing community. It says that 80% of any early stage investment, I mean pre-series A investment, 80% of the return comes from picking the right, company or founder. And so that is a disproportionate amount. It goes back to exactly what Tony is saying. Sometimes even the founder doesn't know where they're going to take the company. Mm-hmm. But if you have those right ingredients at a foundational level, you can make many plants grow, or you can take this one plant and turn it into this huge tree. And, we really over-index on that. And we spend a lot of time just getting to know the person, going back and forth with them, understanding what their hopes and dreams are, how resilient they are, to Tony's point. For me, there's two things that I always look for. What is their level of self-awareness? And what is their level of hunger? I think these are superstar qualities when you put them together. If you have someone who's extremely hungry but not self-aware, they might just go running in the wrong direction. If you have someone who's extremely self-aware but not hungry, they might not be able to move the dial as much as possible. So this is something that we index on heavily.
Super good tips for people looking to invest. Yeah, no, thank you for providing that. So next question then. We had people from, actually SquarePeg, one of Stashway's investors, one of the partners was on here before, and he talked a little bit about how venture capital invests into startups, right? So obviously this comes at a later stage, but for people who don't know, what would you say is the difference between angel investing and venture capital? Because a lot of times it kind of gets commingled, right? It's startup, yeah. And people think like, oh, I'm investing in a startup. Is
I think
the same thing?
There are the no-brainer differences, which you've already pointed out, Philippe. There are, there is a size difference, right? Venture capitalists are also very incentivized to own a certain part of a company. So, they will come in and say that, look, it's extremely important for us to align our interests, and we would love to earn maybe 15 to 20% off your company based on this investment. These are all the right things to do, right? Because a VC is an institutional investor. They sit on a company's board. And so it's extremely important for everybody to get deeply involved in the work of the company. Meanwhile, I think what I would say is the difference with an angel investor is an angel investor is like a confidant. They're like your conciliary. They're working with you in the shadows. They're not going to actually come in and tell you how to run your business or do too much with respect to strategic help. The VCs are much, much, much better place to do that. Where the angels will come in and help is, what Tony mentioned before. Open up the network. Give you access to people that you would never would have had. Help you hire. Do those maybe non-obvious things that often get left out. And also maybe just, pick up the phone at 2 a.m. in the morning when you really need someone to talk to and brainstorm about, hey, should I take that next Series B round or not? And so I think these are those no-brainer differences. Size, the level of activity and involvement, and so on.
Yeah, just to build on what Alap just said, VCs are professional investors. They typically manage other people's money. And when the GP, I mean, the general partner is managing the fund, they invest a little bit of their own money, which is typically, you know, between 1% and 2% of the overall size of the fund. But at the end of the day, they manage the money of other people. And those people are usually called, you know, limited partners, LPs. If you look at angel investor, most of the time, they go earlier than a VC. They go very, very early. As I said before, you know, pre-product, pre-revenues. Well, the VC would go slightly later. And the size of the check of a VC is significantly larger. I think the flip side to that is, you know, network like XN Network. When angel investors are coming together, then, you know, the overall amount that is invested in a company can be on par of what a VC can invest. But the check size per individual investor is actually smaller than what a VC can invest.
So then how do you differentiate yourself then from, if you talk about the XN Network, you just said you're pooling different angel investors together, right? And you're almost on par of a VC in terms of size then when you do an investment. How do you differentiate? Is it still that you invest very, very early on versus a VC?
Yes, that's right. I mean, XN Network is a collective of investors that are typically coming from the tech industry. But they do invest directly most of the time in the company, right? As opposed to a VC that is actually, you know, aggregating, you know, the amount from the limited partners and invest in the startup. For us, you know, at XN Network, it's every single individual that are investing in the company.
Okay, so not, yeah, okay, that makes perfect sense. So thanks for explaining that. So let's say, for example, you know, our listeners are interested, you know, they want to learn more about angel investing. They maybe want to be an angel investor. They have cash on the side. Who can all be an angel investor? Is there anyone that can start investing in companies? Or
so let's start by
that they should look out for?
Looking at the local law in the country that our listeners are in. There are guidelines with respect to, you know, who should be investing in a risky asset class of this sort. In Singapore, for example, where we are based, we look at the definition of an accredited investor as someone who is, you know, par for the course to become an angel investor. I think that's point one, and that's where we should start. I think the second is really looking inward and asking oneself how much time they have to dedicate to this, right? People with a lot of time or people who get a lot of energy from this sort of activity can really afford to not just write a check, but to go deep with companies. People who do not maybe can, you know, band with others and provide value, but also, you know, not be spending a disproportionate amount of time helping a company. It can come in all shapes and sizes, right? But being very self-aware about it right up front and saying, this is how I would like to contribute, is a good, very important question to ask, because we've seen some investors actually not do this and then end up with maybe outcomes that they weren't quite pleased with.
I would say that angel investing is not for everyone. I mean, it really depends on your risk tolerance. And, you know, everyone has a different style of investing, right? Some people would prefer to invest in a very safe, you know, asset class. You know, it could be property investment or, you know, ETF. Some other would be way more aggressive, and angel investing might be more for them, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Like I said, I've done a few of those myself, right? I was just thinking by myself back when I did my first one. Why did I do it at that stage? while I'm thinking, maybe you guys have the answer for yourselves, but when did you feel from a financial standpoint that you were ready to make those investments? Like you said, they're more risky. You know, like you're very early on, you don't know where this money's gone. So obviously there's some risk controls that we can talk about next. But when did you feel like in your career you were at the point where you said, okay, yeah, I can do this. It's a certain percentage maybe of my income, as percentage of my net worth, that I can kind of like use that to bet on some of those.
You know, it's a great question, and now that you ask it this way, I'm just wondering why I wasn't a little more quote unquote deliberate or intelligent about it. But I mean, my honest answer is, I just love startups. I've loved them all my life. I've worked in technology, you know, for all 16 years of my career. So even in investment banking, I was in technology. And, you know, one thing I realized was that the bulk of, you know, maybe the interesting conversations I was having was startup gossip, right? To put it in that term. And I was just like, well, if this is what gives me so much energy and I enjoy this to this degree, I had also just finished, you know, writing the Google Temasek report with wonderful colleagues at Google and Temasek. And I said that, listen, you know, it's time to invest in this wonderful startup ecosystem we have in Southeast Asia. I could talk about this all day and night. I might as well turn this into something that allows me to add some value. So I think that was just the way I thought about it.
Well, it sounds like you have real passion about it, right? So I think, you know, and if people are passionate about a certain subject, it doesn't matter what
fingers
it is,
crossed.
And they go deep in it, it usually leads to good things.
Yeah, right? With that, given the time that you need to dedicate to do it really well, you have to be passionate, right? I mean, it's super important. But just to answer also to your question, for me, it's also a way to diversify, right? I'm not only investing, you know, in startups. You know, I also invest, you know, in property, in equity, in ETF. It's a nice way to diversify your portfolio. And on top of that, of course, there is the passion.
Yeah, and this is an underappreciated point, I think. And so I'll just pick up from where Tony's going. So, you know, it's not like Tony and I invest in every single company together. One thing I do end up doing is Tony and I will almost on every single investment be intellectually sparring with each other. Right. So one thing I might, you know, advise others who are planning to get in is find someone or a group of people that you can have these discussions with. Conversation always catalyzes better decisions, especially when you can have them with people who have that same level of energy, that same level of understanding or that passion. And so, you know, it's just if you see the difference in my answer and Tony's answer, that is exactly what helps me and him make good decisions, I think. And after 3 years of kind of working with him, I think I would recommend it to everyone. Do find yourself someone who you can invest together with.
No, perfect. And then I think even back in college days, we had, you know, because when I studied finance, we had the finance club.
Exactly.
And discussed different investments.
Exactly.
It's kind of the same thing, right? It's super cool. So I really enjoy that. And I think it's great what you guys have built there. So we talked about who can be an angel investor and what you kind of have, like kind of like how you guys became angel investors. But let's talk a little bit about the risks of being an angel investor. We touched on them a little bit, right? It's a little bit more risky asset class. But what would you say are the main risks that angel investors
I think, you know, the main risk is losing your investment. And I think you need to be mentally prepared for that, right? Because there is more chance that you are going to lose everything than you are going to get a unicorn, right? My advice to mitigate the risk would be not to be middle of the road. And once you decide to be an angel investor and basically dedicating time to do it and effort and to do it right, by essentially diversifying your risk by investing in many companies, right? That is really important. You need to diversify your bets.
Is there any amount of companies you think that would be okay? When you consider
for myself, I would say a year making, you know, 5-6 investments.
Okay.
So, you know, if we just look at the math that the Kauffman Foundation puts out, and, you know, there's many other large VCs as well as LPs who do the math, portfolio math is quite simple, right? It's just, if you have a portfolio of N companies, one company is going to return N minus one. So if you have a portfolio of 30 companies, one out of those companies is going to return as much as the other 29. So to Tony's point, I guess finding that superstar, that quote-unquote unicorn, is really important, and you need to give yourself shots at goal to make that happen. You know, the more shots you give yourself at goal, the more chance you have of that happening. But inherently, of course, the more shots you take, the more at risk your capital is. So I think I would say anyone who is looking to go into angel investing should apportion an amount of their total net worth that they are okay to lose so that they can create an opportunity for themselves to get that special company that will return everything and much more. In fact, it's a little bit contrarian, but I think it's needed. It's really needed because it's not going to be the usual buy 20 stocks and hold for 20 years and you'll get an amazing outcome. It's almost certainly not going to happen that way.
Yeah. No, and I very good points. I actually, all the angel investments that I've made in my net worth statement, they're actually all at zero until they actually pay out. For me, like that way, you know, you're also stressed less about it, right? These things are at zero right now. If they become something really great, but you don't feel the loss, right? You don't feel like, oh, you need to be mentally prepared to make that investment and say, hey, I write this off until it becomes something. That's at least how I cope
and
with it.
And I think you've just provided one of those nuggets that almost all successful angels have in the back of their minds. Which is, you know, you always get asked the question, how do you sleep at night when you've invested in so many companies? It is because I've done the math and I know that maybe this amount is kind of okay. And I am all right to take that swing. It is a swing, right? And they always say angel pre-A venture is a grand slam business, right? It is not the amount of hits you get. It is the magnitude of that one hit. So you want to be smashing that one shot straight out of the park because it does everything else. And so it's very difficult for, you know, the rest of us who've, you know, maybe been investing in the markets for a long time to understand. But this is the one thing I just harp on again and again.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's what I said. Like you take that cash, you move it from your, you know, from your personal balance sheet and you just move it to zero. And of course it's there in the back of your mind. But at least that way you kind of prepare yourself mentally, like you said, right? It's not like you can't sleep at night anymore. And I even, you know, when we do a lot of the financial planning and financial wellness talks at Stashaway to companies and employees, I always tell them the same thing, right? There's always risk and reward. Whatever you invest in, you need to be, there's a monetary number that you need to hit. You need to have a certain amount of return in order to retire, right? But you need to also sleep at night so that you don't destroy your portfolio, right? And you completely sell out and stuff like that. And the same goes for angel investing, right? Just make sure that you have almost earmarked this as a zero. And then if it happens, great, right? It could be substantial.
Yeah, and guess what? There is another non-intuitive point around this. When you interact with founders, if all you're about is securing your investment, they're going to feel it and you're not going to be able to help them that much. But if you bring to the, if you show up with just that completely, you know, that spirit of, I'm going to assist you no matter what, that actually ends up, you know, ensuring that founders then talk you up. And when founders start discussing you as an investor, that's when you actually have a better shot at getting one of those amazing companies. So what you've just described has another amazing side benefit because it helps founders see the investor for who they really are, because it helps them show up in a way that's not always money-minded.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think, like you mentioned just now as well, it's like if you show that to the founders, right? And you, like you said, in the beginning, you invest in the founder. You never know what they do 10 years down the road, right? They will come back to you and maybe that now is the right deal, or they introduce you to other people. I think it's also about networking, right? And I think that's the part that I enjoy a lot. I met so many people and so many, you know, different other angel investors through the companies that I invested a part of it as well. It's a very cool community to be part of. And that's also one thing I enjoy about angel investing as well.
Agreed.
Yeah. No, let's move on though. So we talked about risk. We talked about how and who. Let's talk about how to find deals. You guys are part of a network. So I assume, startup founders are getting introduced to you guys, or maybe they even like reach out to you from the website or through, again, network over time is being built, right? But if someone is new to this field, what are your tips for people to become part of a network or even just get involved in this?
I feel it's can be very intimidating to start angel investing. And as I said earlier, you know, you don't want to be middle of the road, and you really want to commit to it. And in order to do so, I think it's important to be surrounded by like-minded people, people that you can trust and discuss, you know, investment opportunities. More importantly, as you said, is the deal flow. I feel that when you are on your own, you have your own network. But if you are part of a broader group, then you can leverage, you know, this entire group and this entire network in order to get a better deal flow. So basically, it's almost a way to augment your own deal flow. So I would definitely encourage people to be part of an angel group or a larger network. But it doesn't mean that you shouldn't go out there as well yourself and, you know, attend demo days and talking to VCs. I think you also need to build your own network and your own deal flow. But I feel, you know, being surrounded by a broader group can be reassuring.
Tony, did you do your first angel investing when you joined the XA network, or did you do one before?
No, my first investment was when I was in Hong Kong back in 2013. And I did it as part of an angel network at that time based out of China called AngelVest. And so I was part of that that network.
Okay. Okay. No, I was just interested, to hear how you got into it. What about
I have some
you,
very technical advice here. job one, add angel investor to your LinkedIn profile. You receive startup founders reaching out, and they will want to speak to you. They will send you their material, their decks. My ask is that everybody who does this, of course, is extremely respectful of any founder's time. Founder time, in my opinion, is the most precious time in the world. So do go through their material with great care. Please never share it with anyone else because they've shared it with you in confidence. But what that will allow you to do is to actually figure out, A, whether you have energy for this, and then B, you can start to develop that muscle memory. Right? Like, I like to see this in a company, but I actually probably don't like to see that. And this is my personal style. Coming up with a personal style is deeply important in the world of angel investing, because your brand really matters. And you can only build a brand if you can add value. And when you can add value is when you find something that you're passionate about, that you like, and so on and so forth. So that would be just my tactical step one. And you know, after you see about 15 companies, I would say start writing small checks and then see if you're okay. If you're not sweating it too much and you're still getting a ton of energy, you know you're ready for angel investing at that point. And then I think Tony's advice around a network, around like-minded people, you should go full all out to try and find those networks and people, and then you can start investing with them as well.
Yeah, no, good, very good tips, especially on the LinkedIn one. I think a lot of people will start doing this now after listening to this. Let's see what the feedback is and how many people are reaching out to them. But great tips. We know now how to find deals. What do we look for in deals before we start investing? Like you both probably get tons and tons of founders reaching out, right? What are the top things that you look for before you start
investing? So going back to where we started, I think it is incredibly important for every startup to be able to communicate, to tell a story, and that the founder should be able to tell this story. So the very first thing I look for is, believe it or not, how simple and easy to follow the deck is, right? If that is in great shape, then I think a 60-minute call with the founder where you go back and forth is incredibly important, because then you can start to get a feel for the business. Post that, there is work at the end of it as well. everybody exits those calls as investors having more questions than answers. It's time to start contacting people in your own network to ask those questions, do some due diligence in the background, see who else is operating in that space, do a little bit of a competitor analysis. And then when you feel like you're at 60 to 70% of information, I would say go for it if you're comfortable. If you wait for 100%, you're waiting too long. The best startup founders will actually get picked up by other people and you won't get in. So I think there's a very fine line you have to manage there. Don't invest at 50%. Don't wait till 100%. Go at like 70%.
Just enough, just above, right? Just above.
From my side, and Alap alluded to it before on the investment thesis, and that's something I developed over the years. One of the very first thing I'm looking at is why the founding team or the founder is actually based in Southeast Asia. Because typically I invest only in Southeast Asia. And I feel that it's very important, when a founder is in this region, that they are here for a reason. And they are here to solve some of the biggest, challenges of Southeast Asia. If the answer is no, when I ask this question to the founder, usually I pass. Because I feel, the company can be built somewhere else, like in the Silicon Valley, for instance. So just to summarize, the founder has to be here for a reason because he or she can make an impact, on that part of the world.
No, I think this is exactly, you're commending the point from Alap before, right? That you need to find your own DNA of investing, right? And I think you just basically lined out yours and why you would make an investment into one of those companies. So that's awesome. Moving on then, what's the usual investment amount? A lot of people will ask themselves, hey, yes, we talked about you have to be an accredited investor in Singapore and some other countries you don't have to, or you have different requirements. But for your own, what are the typical checks for an angel investor? Do you have to be... You have to invest $100,000. Can you start at $5,000? What's usually that amount?
I can tell you what is the average I've seen so far. Typically, the average is around $20,000 to $25,000 US per investment. But again, it depends of the amount of conviction that the person has, right? I mean, I've seen people writing check of 100K, other writing check of 10K, right? But I would say in average, 20 to 25K seems to be the right number.
Yeah, I would agree. I would also say that there are platforms that allow you to take that number down if you'd like. There are syndicates that you could join on AngelList, which is a very trusted platform that is used globally. You would most likely get more access to a US-centric deal flow in this case. I would also say that there is another... maybe underappreciated point, which is how do you back up that initial investment that you put in? So say an angel investor invests at the pre-A round, a seed round, say, and then the company ends up raising an A. At that point, you can actually double down on your investment, maintain your ownership and so on. So this is not something I'm going to give advice on. It is just another consideration when it comes to, how much do you want to deploy per company? It can be the 25,000 that Tony mentioned, but it could actually be 20,000 and then another 30,000 when they raise the next round. And you could have a total of maybe 50. So these are things that are very important to consider once you have some experience. So I would encourage everyone to take those baby steps before getting there.
No, absolutely. And I think with those numbers, I think people can kind of like, when we talk about 5 to 8 companies or maybe 10 companies to invest in, maybe have now a little bit better of an understanding of what kind of capital is required to actually start this as well. So that's awesome. What's the time frame then for a profitable angel investment? So say you guys do, angel investment, pre-seed, seed round kind of thing. What has been in your history of investments so far been the time frame until you say see any
I mean
kind of
it's typically more a marathon than a sprint, right? I mean, you have to be prepared that it's illiquid as an investment, So it's not like, you know, when you invest in equity or ETF, you cannot liquidate your investment easily. So you at least need to be prepared to have your investment stuck, you know, with the company for a minimum of 5 years. And I would say sometime even 10 years. The other thing I wanted to mention is, and it's also back to your previous question, is when you invest in a company, say you invest 25K, you also need to be prepared to follow on. So for instance, you invest in a seed round, you might want, you know, to double down your investment and take on your prorata for the Series A round, right? So you still need to put money aside for the following rounds.
Anything to add, Alap, on your side, or?
No, I think we've got it covered. I would say that 7 years is my horizon on, you know, on timeline. And okay. I think that this is something that we probably should have said at the start as well, right? One, you have to be ready to maybe let it go to zero. Two, it can take time to go to zero. So it'll take that seven, 8 years.
Yeah. Which I actually quite frankly like. You know, a lot of people, if they're jittery about investments in general, you know, when you have just a portfolio of ETFs or like some stocks and you can easily buy and sell them, it can also be a detriment, right? Whereas something, like I said before, I always just, you know, mark them as zero on my own personal balance sheet, these angel investments. The great thing is you don't think about them, right? They take a long time. You can't take the money back out. They're kind of there. And then hopefully something else. It gives a lot of also, I'm just losing the word, but not, it's not patience, but it kind of forces you to invest and stay with it, right? Be very, there's no way
in or fact, out. Charlie Munger has this line where he says, never interrupt compounding unnecessarily. And that's what this gives you, right? It's just there and hopefully it compounds and gets to a great outcome.
No, absolutely. Oh, that's awesome. And a couple more questions and we're done. But one question I have for you is, what is your best investment so far? And, you know, happily for you guys to share also some of the companies you invested in, if you want to give them a shout out for the listeners to use their services maybe or not. But what's the best investment or the most excited investments?
This is a dangerous question you ask us.
Because they should be, because they're all going to be excited and they're all going to be good.
We love them all. I think the way I would answer this question is,
correct.
There are companies that end up showing a lot of traction very quickly. And then there are companies that take some more time. I'll answer the question in terms of traction because, you know, I've got maybe something to share on that front. So the company that, you know, I've invested in that's kind of shown the most traction in the least amount of time has been a phenomenal business out of Indonesia called Bukukas. It was, you know, very, very privileged and honored to work with, you know, one of my favorite people in the Southeast Asia ecosystem, Krishnan, and of course his amazing founding team. And we backed that company. They've since been, you know, invested in by Sequoia Capital. And, you know, just to watch the simplicity of the product, the simplicity of the problem that they're solving, and the outsized impact. 2.5% of Indonesia's GDP now goes through the Bukukas app. And Bukukas, you know, in its very simplest, is a ledger app for warungs in Indonesia. And, you know, just to see that sort of pain point is getting solved, it's so inclusive. It's so heartwarming. And I'm so proud of what that team does. It's just an honor to, you know, be an investor. And you feel so good about this because you're getting to participate in this sort of impact for this wonderful region.
Yeah, from my side, I made 20 investments, so it's very hard, you know, to pick one of them. But I would also answer along the same line as Alap in terms of traction, and I also give an example from Indonesia. It's a company named Sampingan, and this company has created a platform for on-demand workforce, so really enabling the gig economy. They just raised the Series A with Altara Capital I invested at Seed together with Golden Gate Ventures. And the reason why I invested, apart from the fact that that I really believed in the model, it's also the founding team, and particularly, you know, the founder Vishnu Nugrahadi, with a former Gojek executive. And I was very impressed, you know, by his drive, his resilience, his clarity as well. And I really decided, you know, to back him, more importantly than the overall business, even though the model is, I think, very exciting.
That's good. No, super, super interesting companies. I have to research them myself. So it sounds like really cool projects that they have going on. So to finalize and, you know, to leave the audience with something to take away, not that they already learned quite a lot about the topic. This was awesome, both of you. But what is something that you guys are excited about? What are you maybe it's something you're researching, or, you know, some field that you might be wanting to invest in. Is there anything particularly maybe in Southeast Asia or anywhere in the world that you're really fond of or looking forward to?
I'm particularly excited about any kind of startup or industries that are the backbone of the Southeast Asia economy. So basically anything that can help, you know, growing the internet economy in the region and solving some of the biggest challenges, I'm all for it. Example would be startups in the logistic business, in the e-commerce business, in fintech, solution for SMBs. So all of that are vertical that I'm particularly excited about, you know, in Southeast Asia.
Yeah, for me, it's just the last bit that Tony mentioned. It's SME tech. So Southeast Asia has the distinction of, you know, an incredibly productive SME ecosystem. If you look at the fact that Southeast Asia has about 70 million SMEs, so there is volume there, right? There's 70 million small and medium enterprises in Southeast Asia. These 70 million contribute about 60% of the GDP in the region. So not only is there volume, but there is a large amount of dependence. There's a large amount of, you know, excitement and value that these SMEs are creating. So I am just incredibly, enormously excited about backing companies and startups who are digitizing the Southeast Asia ecosystem in partnership with these SMEs. So I think that's something that just the more I see of, the more I want to invest in. And it just feels like this will stand the economy, it'll stand Singapore, it'll stand the rest of Southeast Asia in such good stead going forward. So very, very excited about that.
Oh, great. That's awesome. And last but not least, do you want to mention where people can find you guys or find more about the XA network? Is there resources that people can take a look
at? Yes, so we have a very active LinkedIn page, so please look us up at XA Network. Our website is www.xanetwork.co, and you can follow us on Twitter at NetworkXA.
Awesome. Yeah, we'll add those links also to the show notes under this podcast, so you can easily reach Alap and Tony as well. So both if you thank you again so, so much for being with us today. We really appreciate it. I know it's always busy, and thank you for making the time. Really
thank you,
appreciate
Philip.
It.
Thank you so much.
That's it for the show this week. Thanks for listening. If you like what you heard, subscribe and leave us a review. The reviews really help us, and we love reading your comments as well. In Your Best Interest is hosted by me, Philip Müller. We're produced by Stashaway, and we're mixed by Mo Remley.